This is Jan Hawkins speaking this morning with Alice Cherry, co-founder and staff attorney with the Climate Defense Project in Berkeley. Welcome to KABU, Alice Cherry.
Hi, Jan. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's first talk about the work of the Climate Defense Project. Some is implicit in the title, but what kind of climate defense work do you do?
Yeah, sure. So we work on cases across the country, and so far we've been focused on defending climate activists, so people who are doing civil disobedience, who are doing direct action kind of as a last resort to try to stop fossil fuel projects from being built, often right at home in their own communities. And among these folks and folks in the climate movement more broadly, there's been a lot of interest lately in a particular legal argument that's called the necessity defense. And so that's where a lot of our work at Climate Defense Project has been concentrated. There aren't many other lawyers doing these kinds of cases, and so there's kind of an unmet need for it.
And many here in Oregon are familiar with the Valve Turners, a case that, as Ken Ward, that's being tried on appeal in Mount Vernon in a few weeks, and another case of the Zenith activists protesting Zenith in Portland, who are trying to use a necessity defense at trial later this month. Can you explain the elements of the necessity defense as perhaps both a legal and a political strategy?
Yeah, so it's also known as the choice of evils defense. It's a very old common law doctrine that can be found in the laws of most states and some other countries. And basically, it allows leeway for a person to violate a law when necessary to avert a greater harm. And so the classic example is the baby in a burning building, right, where a person trespasses and breaks into a building in order to save a child in danger. In that kind of situation, the courts recognize an exception to the usual legal rule, and the person committing the trespass wouldn't be held responsible. Generally, arguing a necessity defense requires meeting a few criteria, and it's pretty common sense. You have to show that you were attempting to avert a greater harm, so in other words, greater than whatever harm you may have caused through your law breaking. Often, you're also required to show that the harm was imminent. You have to demonstrate a causal nexus. In other words, you know, was it reasonable to think that you could actually avert the harm using your chosen method of intervention? And then finally, you have to show that you had no option but to break the law. So there were no other realistic ways of accomplishing the same goal short of breaking the law. So that's the necessity defense. Today it's used in many political protest cases as well. This began with the protests against the Vietnam War and has continued ever since then, which is how climate activists got the idea.
What are the most difficult elements of the defense to argue? I know, and perhaps specifically in the climate movement, but in general, what are the hardest thresholds for juries? And I think it's also important to note that the defendants claim not guilty by reason of moral necessity. There is a long history of civil disobedience where activists claim that yes, I am guilty, I did this, but this is how is this different from other kinds of uses of the court around civil disobedience? And then what are the hardest elements?
Yeah, so that's true. It is technically a legal justification, so it's not necessary to plead guilty. You plead not guilty, as you mentioned. In these cases, the argument is very similar to what I described. You're just mapping it onto a different set of circumstances. So, for instance, when you have activists who are stopping deliveries of coal to a coal plant or turning off the flow of oil through a pipeline, they're arguing that that is a necessary response to the climate emergency at this late hour. And generally in these cases, the first two prongs of the defense that I summarized a minute ago are fairly easy to meet. No one can really dispute that the climate emergency is extremely serious and imminent. But those second two prongs about causation and alternative avenues of affecting change, those are the harder ones for most political protest defendants, including climate activists. And so at these trials where defendants are attempting to get courts to give them permission to put on the defense, they're often relying on research by experts to show that our political and legal systems are currently broken and incapable of fixing the problem, but also that nonviolent civil disobedience has a long history of kind of forcing political progress on problems like the climate emergency, you know, problems that are large scale and seemingly intractable and aren't being solved by the systems we have in place.
And the cases themselves involve enormous commitment and preparation and, of course, counter many of the popular and media representations of activists as kind of rioting in the streets or creating mayhem, putting people at risk. And there is that, but this is a very, very deliberative process, whether to take on the defense and to prepare. And a lot of these cases continue for long periods of time with appeals. What, given all of the investments and commitments over time, what are the political dividends? What are the political gains? And perhaps you could mention a few recent and upcoming cases to talk about it less abstractly and more in terms of what's happening on the ground.
Yeah, sure. I mean, preparing to argue a necessity defense can be a helpful tool for a lot of movements because it does force you to think hard about what you've tried first before resorting to civil disobedience and what your argument is for the effectiveness of what you're doing, you know, among other things. And so it's kind of a useful structure for activists to keep in mind as they're planning an action. I think also just, you know, the one reason that this has been such a high priority for many people in different social movements is that being able to make the case to a jury that what you did was justified by the situation is just so important in these cases. It's really hard to go to trial for something and not be able to say why you did it. And especially when you're talking about, you know, the sort of problems of access to the political system and democracy not functioning very well right now, it's really great for juries to be able to hear these cases and act as the community to decide whether someone should be held responsible. It's a really basic way to participate in a democracy. So in terms of recent and upcoming cases, you know, they're happening all over the country and also around the world. They've been going on here in the U.S. for about the last 10 years or so, and some of the earliest cases were in Utah, Florida, Massachusetts, New York, but fossil fuel infrastructure is kind of all over the country, and so these cases are happening everywhere. Lately, we've seen a lot of cases in the Midwest, including Minnesota and North Dakota, as well as in Washington State. And Jan, you mentioned two trials that are coming up in the Pacific Northwest, Ken Ward's trial in Mount Vernon, Washington, and the Extinction Rebellion case against the Zenith facility in Portland. Ken's case is unusual in that it's the only case so far in which an appeals court has delivered a ruling recognizing the climate necessity defense and giving the defendant kind of advance permission to argue it in court. So it'll be one of the first real tests of the climate necessity defense.
And we had a earlier this month, the ninth disappointing decision, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled 2-1 to dismiss the Giuliano versus U.S. lawsuit, a case familiar to many of us here in Oregon, based in Eugene, involving 21 young people who sued the federal government for violating their right to a safe climate and a livable future. This was a civil case, partly unique by the scope of it and that it was against the federal government versus the fossil fuel companies or banks or states. Can you comment on the significance of that ruling and the difference between the legal strategy of a civil suit versus climate actions that involve the criminal courts?
Yeah, so Giuliano is a civil case in which, as you mentioned, a group of young people are suing the U.S. government. They allege that their constitutional rights are being violated by the government's promotion and subsidization of fossil fuel use, and that the government actually has a legal responsibility to implement a climate action plan that fits what scientists are telling us we need to do. So, as you mentioned, the case is in federal court, and for some time now, the government has been filing appeals to try to get the case thrown out. And the government has argued that the plaintiffs don't have standing, in other words, they don't have a right to be in court in the first place. And recently what happened is that the Ninth Circuit, which is a federal court of appeals, issued an opinion in which they agreed with the government's argument and, in fact, did dismiss the case for lack of standing. And essentially what they said is that it isn't feasible for the courts to administer and enforce the remedy that the plaintiffs are asking for, and that they should take their grievances to the executive and legislative branches instead. So as you say, this was a very disappointing outcome. This is an important case that people have been watching closely. It's worth noting that the ruling was not unanimous. The Ninth Circuit is a 3-judge panel, and one of the judges did dissent with a very strongly worded opinion. And the case isn't over yet. I believe the plaintiffs are requesting review by a larger panel of the Ninth Circuit as a first step.
So we can follow this case through the Our Children's Trust website that has some wonderful materials and videos and instructive guidelines on the use of that. But there's also a lot of materials available on your website and following your work, which is also featured in the film Necessity, Oil, Water, and Climate Resistance that I've been involved with. Tell us more about, in closing, about how we follow these cases and the work of the Climate Defense Project.
Well, you can follow updates on our website, which is climatedefenseproject.org. There's also lots of great newsletters to sign up for and groups to follow, including Extinction Rebellion, 350.org. There's a lot of great climate action groups that are spread out across the country and have many local chapters as well.
How important is it for people to fill the courtrooms or to be outside during these cases to show support?
I would say it's important to get involved with some of the actions happening in your community. Courtroom support is helpful too. It's not always possible given the size of courtrooms and sort of, you know, the legal strategies, you know, whether we want people to pack the courtrooms or not, but often that is helpful. And certainly a lot of these campaigns doing civil disobedience need support from people in various ways throughout the process.
Well, thank you so much, Alice Cherry, for being with us this morning and for your important work with the Climate Defense Project, and we'll continue to follow you.
All right. Thank you very much, Jen.